up next on Art Focus, host Joseph Galavan interviews Mary Weaver Chapin, the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum, about David Hockney's show of 16 etchings called A Rake's Progress. First, a couple announcements.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Food Wars 8, hosted by Clinton Street Theater. This annual music and comedy festival is also a food drive and will feature entertainment from August in Blue, Bad Habit, Tragedy, Boomer, Belinda Carroll, and more. Again, that's Food Wars 8, Sunday, June 21st at 5 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland 5, presenting an evening with Brazilian classical guitar duo, the Assad Brothers, with Romero Lubombo, Wednesday, June 24th at the Winningstad Theater. Tickets and information for the Assad Brothers is available at portland5.com.
Andy Warhol looks at screen. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol looks at screen. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Galavan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Mary Weaver Chapin. She's the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum, and she's here to talk about David Hockney, A Rake's Progress. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Mary.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Joseph. Thanks for having me.
David Hockney produced this set of prints in the early 60s. He called them A Rake's Progress. And he details his arrival in New York City and the things that went on. Just tell us where the inspiration came, because the term rake, you know, is very common in English literature. But tell us what a rake is and who was the visual inspiration for Hockney.
Hockney's suite of 16 prints was published in 1963, and as you say, it was a visual story, semi-autobiographical story of Hockney's first visit to the United States. And he decided to tell his story through the lens of William Hogarth's celebrated tale, A Rake's Progress. Hogarth had created a wonderful suite of 8 paintings and then engravings after them in the 1730s, chronicling the rise and fall of a young man. And at the time, a rake was considered usually an aristocratic young man who lived a life of pleasure. So Hockney was really looking back to this 18th century source of William Hogarth's engravings to tell his own story.
So what happens? A rake would get a lot of money, and then what would they do with it?
Well, in Hogarth's tale, he chronicles how a young man named Tom Rakewell, lest anyone not get the point, we're talking about a rake here. Tom Rakewell inherits a fortune from his father. And so he immediately gets outfitted to move to the city, abandoning his pregnant fiancée, Sarah Young. So the first plate, we see him getting new clothes while his girlfriend weeps, holding their betrothal ring, and her mother yells at Tom. It's really fun if you're standing in front of the prints. You don't need too many clues to figure out what's going on, because Hogarth loads the images with tons of details and hints about the narrative. In fact, he called this his novel in paint, or his novel in engraving, his modern moral subjects. As you might expect, Tom inherits a ton of money and he moves to the city to live a life of pleasure. He goes to the brothel. He goes to the gambling dens. He throws away his money in the most foolish manner, and he's soon completely bankrupt. Once he's out of money, he only has a few options. One of the tried and true methods for getting more money when you are out, of course, is marrying an old maid. So he finds a wealthy old woman to marry. gains her money, and then again promptly loses it before he descends into debtor prison and finally into madness. And the final scene of the series shows Tom Rakewell in the infamous Bethlehem Hospital, better known as Bedlam, where he is utterly lost to madness.
Hockney arrived in New York and he was this young guy and he just loved it. It was so different from England. It was very unrepressed. He had a great time. He draws this series of, what are they, drawings? Are they ink, a watercolor? What are they?
They are etchings with aquatint, and he stuck with a very muted palette. He just used black ink and a little bit of red for highlights. He arrived in New York on his 24th birthday, so he was still a very young man, but he was already gaining some artistic success in England. He was a graduate of the Royal College, was already noted as a promising rising star. And so when he sold enough art to scrape together some airfare, he decided he wanted to get to New York right away. So he arrives, as I said, on his 24th birthday and was completely taken by the city, just enthralled by the open climate, as you mentioned, especially as a young gay man, seeing the physical culture and the nascent gay scene in New York City was a revelation for him. So he came up with the idea of doing a series of prints. He was going to do 8 prints following the Hogarth narrative. And word got back to his college that he had this project underway. And they said, no, make it 24 prints and we'll publish it as a book. And they eventually negotiated back and forth and came up with a number of 16. So for every one Hogarth, there are 2 Hockneys. And when you visit the exhibition, you'll see that they're facing each other on the wall. So you can go back and forth and see the visual inspiration and then how it plays out in Hockney's series.
Did he engrave them the way Hogarth did?
He used a similar printmaking technique. Hogarth used engraving, where he's pushing a tool through the copper plates. Hockney used etching, which employs acid to bite the plate. So you'll notice in Hockney, it's a little bit freer looking. Hogarth had to build up his lines using a lot of parallel lines, something we call cross-hatching, in order to build depth and volume. Where Hockney employed a much more, people sometimes think of it almost like cartoon-like effect. Very simple line drawings, almost like illustrations in a marvelous way for the story to unfold.
This style is, it's so kind of naive. The sort of bodies are half finished. There's no background. The perspective's all wrong. It's just totally different from what you'd expect. People be commissioning a book of this in the early 60s. Was this his style up till then, or was this a departure? Do you know?
You do see precedents for this in his prints. It's a departure from what he was doing at in his painting, but he had a little bit of experience, not a lot, just a little experience as a printmaker, and he did work in this sort of linear fashion. It's a wonderful way. I love how you mentioned that it's almost a childlike way of drawing, and I think it fits the fact that this is sort of a modern fable, and he's not doing a blow-by-blow of account of this is exactly what happened to me in New York, but sort of a big picture of an artist experiencing this awakening in the big city. So I think this visual language is really appropriate for the story he's trying to tell.
In this version of the story, his money comes from selling a couple of prints to MoMA, is that right?
That's right. So unlike Tom Rakewell, who earned his money or got his money through inheritance, Hockney, the artist, had to earn his money. And so in the second plate of the series, you see him sitting in front of the figure of William Lieberman, who was a well-known curator, print curator at the Museum of Modern Art. And you can see how Hockney draws himself as very small, not fully formed, sort of subservient to the great curator there. And Hockney, it looks like, has asked for $20. And yet out of the mouth of Mr. Lieberman comes the number 18. So we do know that he sold Lieberman prints and it put some spending money in Hockney's pocket. A subsequent print in the series is entitled The Start of the Spending Spree and the Door Opening for a Blonde. And that's a turning point in this series.
So he's pictured with a bottle of Clairol on top of his head?
Yes, that's sort of the turning point. He's got a bottle of Lady Clairol bleach, and he dyes his hair bleach blonde. And that's how we know him today. Mm-hmm. People always picture him with that marvelous mop of white hair. Just as Tom Rakewell in the Hogarth series transforms himself from a country boy in simple clothing to an aristocratic Londoner getting new clothes and a fancy town wig, Hockney here has transformed himself into a new creation, a new vision of who he is. And at the time, Lady Clairol Bleach was using the slogan, "The door opens for a blonde," or "Doors open for a blonde." And so that he incorporates that into his composition and right. into his title.
And there's a big door in the middle of it. It's just, he just seems so free. He's just doing whatever he wants.
Absolutely. And then you see, as he goes through his progress in New York, he was fascinated by American physical culture. So there's a scene where he is watching these handsome young men jogging through Central Park.
Seven Stone Weakling.
Yes.
Right.
And you might have to explain what seven stones would mean.
Oh, well, seven times 14 pounds or whatever that is, you know, 100-pound weakling. He just feels very outsiderish, but also very impressed.
Yes, he had been subscribing to American fitness magazines, sort of physical culture magazines, when he was in London. And I think we might call them almost sort of the precursors to bodybuilding magazines. And he was fascinated by just these beautiful, healthy young men he saw everywhere. And so he transposes, like Hogarth, going through all these different stages. He does his own version of the drinking scene, the tavern scene. And where Hogarth's is a raucous scene that in the Rose Tavern, which was really a brothel of the young rake surrounded by prostitutes, Hockney transforms that crowded, raucous scene into a very subdued gay bar, which is beautifully printed, beautifully composed. And you just see Hockney and a male companion standing at the bar at presumably a locale in Greenwich Village.
Mm-hmm. What point is that in the sequence of 16 prints?
That's about halfway through. So he has, he's come to New York, he's dyed his hair, he's seen these wonderful runners in Central Park, and now he goes to the drinking scene. But also, like the Tom Rakewell, he runs out of money, and Hockney, in this case, metaphorically, marries an old maid and mm-hmm. continues his journey as this artist in New York. And
so he takes up with an old man. And then somehow, what happens? He runs out of money?
Yes, and this part is strictly fiction. But he wanted to honor the sequence of Hogarth's tale. And so when he runs out of money, he is cast aside. And that's a wonderful image of him being thrown into the maw of this imaginary beast. I don't know. What do you think that looks like? Perhaps a...
looks like Godzilla.
A Godzilla. And then he meets, the title of the next print is Meeting the Other People. Now, earlier in the series, he had met the good people, meeting the good people. Now he's meeting the other people. And they're people who look like him. They're young men. They have transistor radios in their ears. They're wearing the T-shirts of the local radio station, WABC. And some critics have taken this as... his indictment of the commercialism and materialism of the United States. So once he has no money, he's cast out, and he's not with the good people, he's with the other people. And yet he ends up in Bedlam, like Tom Rakewell, yet in Hockney's version, it doesn't look like such a bad place to be after all. It's these identically dressed young men listening to the radio station WABC.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio Portland. My guest this week is Mary Weaver Chapin. She's the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum, and she's here talking about David Hockney, A Rake's Progress. So the other part of your show in the Portland Art Museum is the work Hockney did for the opera, The Rake's Progress. So tell us how that came about.
Hockney published his suite of 16 prints in 1963, and they were very successful. He continued to paint, his star kept rising, and he was approached by John Cox, who was the production designer for the Glyndebourne Opera, Festival Opera. And he asked Hockney if he would consider doing the sets and costumes designs for a new production of Igor Stravinsky's opera based on Hogarth's tale.
And I should point out, Glyndebourne is probably one of the most snobby, you know, uptight opera festivals you could find in England. Even though it is experimental sometimes, but the audience are very, very straight-laced.
Well, that makes it all the more remarkable that they selected Hockney, who was still a young man, and he responded that he'd never done anything like that. And they said, well, you'll be perfect, because we're looking for something new. And so Hockney gathered up his things. He borrowed a record player and got the score for Stravinsky's opera and set about creating designs for the scenes and the costumes. And he really struggled to find a way to honor Hogarth's vision, but also make it something very modern and something his own. And so what he hit upon was using the language of printmaking, using the language of engraving to translate into the stage and costume designs. So that cross-hatching I mentioned earlier, the where you have parallel lines that are then intersected by other parallel lines, becomes the dominant motif for the sets and costumes. And so in some ways, the opera looks like an engraving come to life. Hockney decided to further honor Hogarth's time by sticking to the few colors that were available to printers at the time. So black, red, blue, and green. He used just those three colors plus black, and he ordered these fancy pens from Germany. He was so proud of his pens and set about creating these designs.
So where was he at the time?
At the time, he was in a rented apartment in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is so engaging about this part of the exhibition is that you really see the artist working through concepts and problems. They are sketches. They're not finished designs. So they're very, very fresh. And you can even see him sort of doodling around the margins, trying to get his pens to work. Or in one instance, his a friend or a visitor to the studio has fallen asleep, and Hockney starts sketching his profile in a very unflattering sort of angle. So you're almost looking up his nose. But it gives you a real sense that these were living, working documents.
Mm-hmm. So you have all that. You have all these sketches and things on the wall framed. And there are they called maquettes? What do you call little cardboard models of the
yes,
stage?
Yes, we have watercolor and pen drawings framed. And then we also have these marvelous little dollhouse boxes. We would call them maquettes, where Hockney planned out all the details of the set design. And apparently he had been told by a friend that if you don't give them set designs precisely the way you want them, they might take your idea and run a different direction. So he obsessively created all these details. And when he showed them to John Cox, apparently Cox was utterly flabbergasted. He was expecting a couple loose ideas, maybe some suggestions. And Hockney came with this fully formed vision that was just stunning and really spectacular. Now, that said, there was some collaboration between Hockney and John Cox, but Hockney did have a very clear idea of what he was thinking mm-hmm. on his own.
So the way it looks on stage is very flat. It's, you know, there are big pieces that look like somebody's drawn them by hand. You know, the cross-hatching is very big, obviously, so you can see it from the back. But everything seems very, very flat. There are props and things drawn in, and then there are bits when he marries the when the rake marries his second wife, she has a lot of stuff she's collected, like alligators and things like that. In the opera, they're flat and they just hang from the ceiling. There's so many little details that I think Hockney's taken, You know, the way Hogarth drew little details, he's trying to bring them out.
Oh, I think you're so right. And I think Hogni must have had a marvelous time doing them, because in the exhibition, you'll see he could have just sort of generally indicated, well, you know, a few of these things over here. But he took so much delight in delineating all the details. Even there's a very careful study for the chandelier that hangs in his home, and this mummified alligator you mention, and these other things that his wife, the exotic Baba the Turk, has collected. I imagine Hogni having a very good time. I picture him with a smile on his face as he was designing these, and really bringing so much joy to the project, and honoring Hogarth, as you say. Hogarth has such an overabundance of telling detail in his engravings.
Do you know how the show went down at Glyndebourne?
It was very well received, and it must have been an artistic risk, as you mentioned, but very well received and wonderful for the opera company, but also very good for David Hogni too, who seemed to find fresh inspiration after working on the opera, really freeing him up and giving him a creative push in his studio practice as well.
And he was, I mean, at this point, you know, 1971, Mr. and Mrs. Clark and Percy, his famous, I think it's acrylic, portrait of Ozzie Clark. His career at that point was amazing, and he was very popular. And then he did this stage work, which he'd never done before. What happened to him after that? Did he do more stage work?
Well, he did, and I think it's very interesting looking back to see how open he was to new possibilities. He went on to do a host of additional stage designs for major operas, all of which I believe have been quite well received. And he seemed to take a lot of energy from that. And now we know Hogni as someone who has just this voracious curiosity. He's been interested in the history of perspective. He's been doing these paintings on his iPad. Looking back, we can sort of see the seeds of this openness. Very early in his career, he was someone who was willing to try something new and to go in directions that really challenged him. And I think that's helped keep him so vital and energized throughout this very long career.
In your exhibit, there is a photo collage. That seems to be from a later time. What is it about?
All of the opera designs were from 1975 when he was working on it. And then the final object in the show is a marvelous composite Polaroid done in 1984. It shows the auction scene from the opera from multiple vantage points using Polaroid pictures all lined up together. And Hogni created that in preparation for a major exhibition at the Walker Art Center. It was called Hogni Paints the Stage. It was a celebration of all of his stage designs as of 1985. He's known as one of those artists who will work up until the moment the exhibition opens. And he wanted to really give a sense of what these large-scale maquettes or creations would look like. So he created for the exhibition this scene, the auction scene. And it's marvelous because you're seeing things from different points of view at the same time. And you see him working in this very flat cardboard cutout way with the cross hatching. But it's also a wonderful chance to see Hogni working in photography. He would go on to do all sorts of marvelous composite Polaroids, which he considered almost cubist photography.
Mm-hmm. And what has he done since then? I remember reading about how he explored the camera obscura and the origins of perspective drawing. You know, he's also done a lot of digital work. Do you know whether any of this turns on the point at which he did the Rakes Progress, the opera?
Well, I think that the Rakes Progress showed him that there were so many possibilities out there. I think it really reinforced his natural tendency to be curious about the world. And because it was such a success, it was really validating that point of view. And so, yes, he did go on to do all sorts of interesting research on perspective, the camera obscura, all sorts of digital media. And Hogni's a wonderful commentator on his own work. I really recommend his writings. He has a marvelous book called That's the Way I See It. And he's a very perceptive critic of art. And he has such a marvelous eye and sensibility. You know, you can't necessarily say that about all artists. They might be articulate speaking about their own work, but he has this very broad view that makes him such a fascinating figure. I mean, really one of our most important living artists, I'd say, today.
And he's back in Yorkshire now, is that right?
He is. He's mostly back in Yorkshire. When I was installing the exhibition, I was talking to his staff. They had a member here to oversee the installation. These are such highly valuable works. And they were telling me that he's spending more and more time in Los Angeles again.
Oh, he is?
So, yes, yeah, back and forth.
Right.
But Los Angeles at the moment.
What else have you got coming up at the museum in your department?
Well, Rake's Progress is on the walls. I'm working behind the scenes to put together a show of recent acquisitions. And the last time we did a recent acquisition show for Prints and Drawings was 7 years ago. So I have many, many things to choose from. But one of my guiding criteria is that I want to show things that have never before been on view at the Portland Art Museum. So I have prints, drawings, watercolors, amazing things dating from the Albrecht Dürer's engraving that we recently acquired, all the way to prints that were made a year or two ago.
Mm-hmm. And how do you come by most of this work?
Most of the museum objects come by gift. We have wonderful patrons in town who give us things during their lifetimes or as bequests. And then we also have a small but important acquisition fund. So we are constantly shaping the collection through the things we buy.
Mm-hmm. Where do you go shopping?
Well, I like to go shopping there's a major print fair in New York in November every year. But we have started our own print fair here at the Portland Art Museum called the Portland Fine Print Fair. And that has been held in January. And I have a lot of new acquisitions from that print fair. Mm-hmm. So by print fair, I mean it's a time where we invite very important dealers from all over the country, from Europe, from Asia, invite them to our ballroom and have a weekend of print sales.
Is this open to the public?
It is. It's open to the public. We've only done it for 2 years. It's been very popular. And the dealers have been so appreciative of the Portland audience. They say that people come in and ask great questions, and it's really an energetic weekend. It's a lot of fun.
So the public might go in and buy an original print there.
Absolutely.
But you're also looking at stuff.
I'm also looking.
Right?
So we vet all the dealers so we know that they are reputable, they're honest, and we have things that start as low as, I saw a 12-year-old boy who purchased an $85 print, and there were prints that we purchased for the museum that were north of $40,000, $50,000. Mm-hmm. So big price range, great quality.
So the new acquisitions should be on display in August?
Yes, they will be on the walls on August 8th. I invite everyone to come look. It will be a huge range of styles and time periods, so come find your favorites.
I'm Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Mary Weaver-Chapin, the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum. She was here talking about David Hockney's work, A Rake's Progress, and also his work for the opera, The Rake's Progress. The show continues through August the 2nd at the Portland Art Museum. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO, Mary.
My pleasure. Thank you, Joseph.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol looks a scream.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be the sponsor of the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 2nd through the 5th at Waterfront Park in Portland. The Blues Festival includes cruises like the Blue Bayou Cruise, the Rock the Boat Dance Cruise, Drifting Blues Cruise, and the Sail on Sister Cruise, as well as after-hour performances featuring Galactic, Charmaine Neville, Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, and the Paladins. Again, that's the 28th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, Thursday, July 2nd through Sunday, July 5th at the Waterfront Park in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.org. FM/Waterfront Blues Festival 2015.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Make Music PDX on Sunday, June 21st in numerous locations around Portland. Make Music PDX is an event for people who love music and the joyous sense of community that music can foster. Portland will be joining over 725 cities internationally who celebrate Make Music Day, with music played throughout the day and throughout the city. Again, that's Make Music PDX all over Portland on June 21st. More information about bands and venues and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Nepal Aid Concert, Saturday, June 20th at 7 p.m. at 4200 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. The event will feature live music by Manda and the Latin Sound Trio, poetry by Alex Dang, Nepali dance performances and lessons, and more. Again, that's the Nepal Aid Concert, Saturday, June 20th, 7 p.m. at 4200 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Muy buenas tardes. Esto es Tania Gómez Daza para KBOO News. A continuación.